May 9th, 2026, and we had a Upasika day today, so I was very happy with how that went and the turnout of that. And not only did a lot of people show up in person to come here and spend the day here at Abayagiri, but then there was also people online, and I just, during the break, got a message that there was over 150 people watching the YouTube live stream, which is kind of unusual for us. So it was very heartening, and very nice that people were showing that type of interest. And now we're just continuing with more teachings and more meditation, more practice. So a full day of practice, it's a great blessing. And just being able to do wholesome things and practice wholesome things, taking precepts, practicing meditation, and listening to reflections. And this is called Dhamma Savana, which is the sharing of Dhamma reflections, sharing of thoughts on Dhamma, conversation on Dhamma, and then discussing Dhamma with each other as well, which is an important way to clarify our own understanding of Dhamma. So this is just a great thing to do, a very good way to spend a Saturday. And it really does, I believe, have a wholesome effect that spreads out into the world. And for any of us who are globally minded, want to do something to help the world, then I do think Dhamma practice is one of the best ways to do that, because with sila, something like sila is just precepts, just virtue is a rare thing in the world. And the more people who give rise to a sense of confidence in the efficacy of following something like sila, then that adds, that counterbalances the energies in the world. So we're adding to the collective goodness of the world through our own virtue, through our own practice. And I do think that's one of the best things we can do for ourselves and for others. And it's quite nice just to be here in this monastery. And it's very nice to get up in the morning, hear the birds singing this time of year, and to be able to have that balance of being on one's own and also being with the community. And I feel like it's a very good balance. And then as time passes, then each day we build upon this and the path unfolds in a very natural way. And so it's not about necessarily making the path unfold, although there are certain things we need to put in place. That's the sila, the daily meditation practice, the contemplations, the panya, sila samadhi panya, the panya, the listening to teachings and reflecting on teachings, having Dhamma conversation with one another. So we put those things in place, right speech, right action, these factors in the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort, and so on. So we put those in place, and then like in the Dhammacakka Sutta, which we chanted this evening, the Four Noble Truths, and being able to see suffering in our experience, using these Four Noble Truths as a framework for how to reflect on our experience. And then over time, things open and we feel a sense of refreshment and peace, well-being, happiness, and develop a mindset where we're just able to be with whatever arises, adapt to whatever happens in our lives. And I like this phrase that from the Ajahn Jayasaro readings today, intelligent responses. So what is letting go? Letting go is wisely responding. Letting go is intelligently responding to things. In a way, the phrase letting go is a bit of a misnomer, because we let go of one thing, we're just going to grab onto another thing if those roots are still there in the mind. So the striking at the heart of addiction is what we're looking at with the Samudaya, the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. We could say it's desire, but also addiction, the addiction to things that are pleasing, and the aversion to things that are displeasing, using that as a framework for experience. And coming back to this sense of, all right, this is what the Buddha is saying from his own experience, that the cause of suffering is this samudaya, this cause of suffering from different types of craving, kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. That's what's causing the suffering that we experience. That just that is what's causing the suffering that we experience. And nothing other than that is causing the suffering that we experience. That's the essential point of the Buddha's teachings. The indispensable point that is good to focus on is that nothing other than those cravings are causing the suffering. And then there's also delusion and ignorance, and those create the illusions that other things other than kamatana, bhavatana, vibhavatana are causing our suffering. It's this person causing my suffering. It's this climate causing my suffering. It's this monastery causing my suffering. It's this relative or spouse causing my suffering. It's this situation that's causing my suffering. Coming back to those Four Noble Truths, using them as a framework for experience. It's my looking at taking responsibility for these things. Because if it's always outside of us and it's not something we're doing, then we're absolutely powerless to do anything about our suffering. But if we have that realization that it's something we're doing, that actually is greatly empowering for us. So I like this word empowerment as well that they use in the Tibetan tradition, because it's like the Four Noble Truths empowerment, the empowerment of realizing, this is something I'm doing. Therefore, I am empowered to do something about it and take responsibility and actually put an end to this suffering. It's within my capacity. It's not beyond any of our abilities to do this. So if it was really coming from outside, it would be absolutely beyond our ability to do anything about the suffering that we're experiencing. But because it's something that the heart is doing, and I won't even say, maybe it's not even right to say that we're doing it, but it's causes and conditions. It's the heart, the mind that is habitually falling into this trap. And therefore there is suffering. And then it's interesting that the Buddha doesn't really give a technique. He said for the Third Noble Truth, there is the cessation of suffering. There's the non-arising. Nirodha can be translated more accurately as non-arising. It's the non-arising of suffering. And he just says that's from the complete absolute relinquishment, giving up, abandonment of that craving and the Second Noble Truth. But then there is a path. So then the Fourth Noble Truth is the path leading to the non-arising of the suffering. So that goes through the right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And so the cultivation of that path, that's what we end up always coming back to, is that in our lives, that is something we can do, is just to be cultivating that path. And that path includes both the times that we're meditating and the times outside of our formal practice of meditation. So we could say when we're doing chanting, sitting meditation, walking meditation, that would be classed as formal practice. And then there's those times outside of our formal practice. So when we're not actually engaging in actual sitting meditation, actual walking meditation, and so on, then that's those times when we still need to be cultivating mindfulness. There's still mindfulness and right effort. And without mindfulness, we won't really be able to modify our behavior of body and speech. So the Buddhist religion is called Dhamma Vinaya. Vinaya deals with body and speech. So the 227 rules of the monks, you can't break any of the rules with just the mind, except in one very rare case where if you have psychic powers and really bad intentions, you can kill somebody with something called the evil eye. That's in the Vinaya. That's the only case of actually breaking a precept with the mind. But other than that, which is we'll just assume that nobody can do that, hopefully. Hopefully nobody's capable of that here. Then it's only body and speech. So the Vinaya deals with body and speech, and the Dhamma deals with the mind. So we could say the training of Dhamma Vinaya is the training of body, speech, and mind. And we could define Dhamma practice as the efforts we make to modify our behavior of body, speech, and mind to be less unwholesome and more wholesome. That is Dhamma practice. We could also say Dhamma practice is the adaptation or the modification of our behavior of body, speech, and mind in order to be more in line with natural truth. And natural truth would be karma, cause and effect, and just investigating and seeing there is a result to actions, there's a result to certain intentions. For example, if there's an intention to harm, and the result of that would be that harm, if we act on an intention to harm and we harm somebody or something, then that karma would say that the harm will come back to us in some way, shape, or form. If we have an intention of kindness, then the law of karma would say that kindness will come back to us in some way, shape, or form. And there are some teachings out there, some ideas that, say the Buddha in the suttas, he says, we can't come to the end of suffering unless you come to the ending of karma. So it's easy to misunderstand that one because we might think, okay, I'm going to undergo all this torment and suffering through living in the monastery to run out my karma. And then when my karma runs out, then something will happen. I'll be enlightened or whatever. Something might happen. Something good will happen. But to wait for our karma to run out, the absurdity of that is that we would also have to experience all the results of our good karma. So when we think about karma, we think it's only bad. Say, oh, that's my karma. Something bad happened. That must be my karma. But also when something good happens to us, that's also our karma. So there's a lot of good karma. There's a lot of good things we have done in the past. And even if we don't want to experience good things, and we don't want to experience, say, may I not experience happiness, but we can't do that because if we've done good karma, we're going to experience happiness. There's even a teaching where the Buddha says, if you think, may I not attain Nibbana, but if you've planted the causes for Nibbana, you'll still attain it, even though you're saying, may I not attain it. Or on the flip side, if you're saying, may I attain Nibbana, but if you don't plant the causes for it, then it won't come about. So it's all about the path. It's all about planting the causes for these things. It's like there's another, there's a story about a Tibetan monk who had this, may I not attain Nibbana. I want to help as many beings as possible for as many lifetimes as possible. May I not attain Nibbana. But then he had planted the causes for Nibbana. And so even though he wanted to go to the hells to help living beings, as he was dying, he started getting visions of these deva realms and great brightness and light and peace, happiness, ease. And he said, no, I want to go to the hell realms. Said, sorry, you didn't create the causes for that. So you can't go there. So he had created all these wholesome causes. So even though he didn't want to have the mind go to the heavenly realms, still, that's just what had to happen because that was the causes and conditions. So if we do all sorts of good things, then there will be good results to that. One of the difficulties is when we start out practicing, there's a time lag. So it's almost like a sick joke of samsara, that there's a time lag between doing our actions and getting the results of them. So it's like, oh, we might do all sorts of good and wholesome things, but we don't yet get the results of it. Therefore, we might think, oh, maybe the practice isn't working, or maybe I'm doing something wrong. But then if we practice long enough and the results of our good karma starts to come to us, then that can increase our confidence immensely. And then, okay, right. Okay, I get it. This is good. This is the right thing to do. Or sometimes if we engage in some sort of unwholesome action, then we might not get the results of it right away. So I think, well, maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe it's not a big deal. But then later on, when it comes back to bite us, then we'll feel distressed about it. So as we experience life, if we investigate experience closely, then we say, oh, this karma thing really is the way it is. There really is causes and conditions. There really is good and bad karma. There really is karma and the results of karma. And then over time, we gain confidence in that. If our karma came back to us immediately, nobody would do anything wrong and everybody would engage in wholesome action, because it would be like putting your hand in a fire. It would burn you immediately. You're like, no, I can't, absolutely can't do that. That'd be impossible. But because there's this time lag, then it's harder to see. And that's why ignorance sometimes can take precedence and say, well, you know, maybe there's this thing that it seems unwholesome, but it, you know, I just kind of need to engage in that and it's not a big deal. So because there's the time lag, it's difficult to do. And then there is the natural wisdom of the mind, which can see impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And the natural wisdom of the mind is kind of similar to the wisdom of the body. So the body has natural wisdom in it. And the natural wisdom of the body would be, say, we put our hand in a fire, and the hand automatically withdraws from the fire. We don't need to tell it to. We put our finger in a light socket and it electrocutes us, and we don't need to tell the hand to retract from that, because it's painful. It hurts. It's immensely painful. It's burning. It's awful. So if I put my hand in a fire, it's going to be very difficult for me to will myself to keep that hand in the fire. It's going to automatically retract. And so when I have my hand in a fire, it's not like I need to consult some sort of instruction manual. What do I do when my hand is in a fire? And it's going to be automatic. So in the same way, if we really see suffering and the cause of suffering clearly in the mind, we don't need to consult the suttas. We don't need to consult the teachings. The mind will automatically retract from suffering. It can't possibly stay there if it really sees it. Now, if it really sees impermanence, it can't stay with the suffering. If it really sees these qualities of existence, these universal characteristics, it's not going to be able to stay there. It's going to want to pull itself out of suffering as soon as possible. But the problem here is that the mind has always been in the fire, so it doesn't know anything different. It doesn't know the immense coolness of Nibbana, of the freedom of suffering, freedom from suffering. And the Buddha uses these analogies. It's like contact is like a cow that's been skinned alive. So anything we experience through the senses, the type of impingement that we're actually experiencing is like a cow that's been skinned. But we don't perceive it as painful because we're normalized to it. Or like consciousness. Consciousness is like a conjurer's trick. So we can't see beyond the veil. And we kind of keep believing the perceptions. We keep believing the stories in the mind, the sankharas. This is completely normal. So the Buddha doesn't do judgments. He doesn't say you're good because you do this, you're bad because you do that. He says, if you do this, there's suffering. If you do that, there's not suffering. So the Buddha is always talking about everything the Buddha talks about is around suffering and the ending of suffering. So when the Buddha classes something as wholesome, why does he class it as wholesome? He classes it as wholesome because it leads away from suffering. And he classes something as unwholesome because it leads into suffering. He classes something as correct because it leads away from suffering. He classes something as incorrect because it leads towards suffering. So that's why the path is speak this way, act this way. This is what leads away from suffering. Not you're a good person if you speak this way, you're a bad person if you speak that way, but that the Buddha's not doing character judgments. He's just saying, if you want to suffer, you can act like that. If you want to be happy, you can act like this. So that's where the precepts come into play. And it's really up to us to choose. There's this incredible freedom. And the Buddha as a leader was really unbelievable, really amazing. And he really walked his talk. He really led by example. And whenever people questioned the Buddha, and he could have easily just said, do it because I'm the Buddha. I mean, I said so. I'm the highest being in the universe. Of course, you know, whatever I say, you should just do. He could have said that. But whenever a questioner would ask him something, he would take time to explain, well, this precept is there because of this and this and this and this. This is why we do this. This is the reason for it. This is the meaning behind it. He would always take the time to elucidate the principle behind every single precept, every single practice. If somebody questioned him, he would patiently answer their question and just, this is why this is done. This is what we do this for. This is the benefit of this practice. This is the drawback of not doing this as practice. This is the benefit of goodwill meditation, meditation on loving kindness and goodwill. This is the drawback of ill will and so on. He would take time to explain it. And even to the extent of these minor protocols. So we have 227 precepts as bhikkhus, but then there's probably a couple thousand minor protocols that you find in the Vinaya, which things like making sure to wipe your feet clean before you go into a dwelling. And there's one around clipping your nails. That's actually a protocol around clipping your nails. And there's also an origin story for every single precept in the Vinaya, and both the 227 precepts and then the thousands of minor protocols outside of that. What Master Xuanhua would call the 10,000-fold conduct. So the bhikkhus who were forest dwellers at one time when the Buddha was still alive, they neglected to look after their bodies, and they were reflecting on the loathsome nature of the body, but they also neglected to look after themselves very well. So they would grow their nails out, and on the alms round, they would have these very, very long nails. Probably many people would have seen like the Guinness Book of World Records, like the long nails, like what happens, they start curling up and they look really freakish and they get all sorts of bacteria on them. So the bhikkhus were growing their nails out very, very long and neglecting looking after their body. This is just the nature of the body. It's like this. And so the lay people complained to the Buddha, said they look like goblins. And so the Buddha calls the bhikkhus together and he says, okay, well, I allow you to clip your nails. This is just normal. Like, yes, you can reflect on the loathsome nature of the body, but it's just normal to look after yourself. Clip your nails. So the Buddha just had to explain something as minor as clipping your nails. So he said, okay, clip your nails. But then a problem arose because of this, because then bhikkhus who were overly zealous clipped their nails too diligently and their fingers started to bleed. But the Buddha said, clip your nails. So then they wouldn't stop clipping their nails. And the Buddha's like, okay. And then he patiently explains, I allow you to clip your nails even with the skin, not further. So he even goes to that extent of telling people how they should clip their nails. And because I just think it's funny because the bhikkhus who are overly zealous, they're like, the Buddha told us to do something. Let's do it to the maximum. But then they took it too far. So the Buddha had to just explain to them the correct way to do it. So it is, I just think as a leader, that's the ultimate example. The Buddha just saying, okay, this is, he really cares for everybody. And even when the monks were doing things that seem just outlandish, he would still take time to patiently correct them and say, no, this is how you do that. This is how you clip your nails. This is how you wear your robes. This is how you eat your food. I mean, we have 30 rules about how to eat and just beautiful conduct while eating. We eat with mindfulness. Everything we do with mindfulness. We try to do with mindfulness. We eat with mindfulness. Walking forward and going back, doing it with mindfulness. And speaking or keeping silent, you know, being clearly aware of what we're saying, of what we're doing, being aware of the effect of it. How much is the attention going out? How much is the attention able to stay in? What's the effect of the attention going out too much? You know, what effect does that have on us? What effect does that have on others? So reflecting on our experience in this way. And we have a lot of these tools at our disposal with the Dhamma Vinaya, the rules around proper conduct in terms of conduct, which is going to lead to ease and well-being, a sense of refreshment, a refreshing joy connected with the training, and daily practice, which is helping us to develop things like patient endurance and truthfulness and goodwill and self-esteem, even confidence. So we have all these things at our disposal. It's just for us to persevere and pick them up and use them, make the most of them. And when we do that, we're going to develop a lot of gratitude and appreciation for what's been given to us on a silver platter. I mean, the Buddha had to go through all these hardships and austerities just to discover the truth. And now we get to receive this from the Buddha, from the Ajahns who have come before us. So it's pretty amazing what we've been gifted here. And behooves us to make the best use of our time. So it's been a long day of practice. I just feel very happy with seeing everybody here and also being able to join everybody in the practices that we've undergone today. So I think that's enough. I'll wish everybody a good evening, and I'll leave the talk there.